Hello and welcome to the Make Ideas Reality Podcast. I'm Justin White, aka the Garage Avenger. Innovating is about staying relevant. Our world is constantly evolving, and it's impossible for a creator to remain relevant if they don't innovate. When a creator continuously innovates, they're more likely to engage the interests of a new audience and connect with people. Imagine if Jimmy DiResta only made things on the bandsaw. Would he be as relevant as he is now? My guest today, Barnaby Dixon, is an innovator in his field of puppetry. Barnaby is at the forefront of design, movement, video, and stage production, and is a true artist. In this show, we talk about where it all began, staying the course even when others don't believe in your abilities. Barnaby unveils his process of making his ideas reality, and we get down into how he has innovated over the years in his design, production, and probably the most important aspect, his mindset. If you don't know who Barnaby is, you're in for a treat. Let's get into the show. In a dark room playing with dolls, his phone on silent, missing calls. Dabcheck, his alter ego creation. Innovation, though, was his salvation. Welcome to the show, Barnaby Dixon.
Thank you very much. Thanks for having me. That was wonderful. The room is less dark since doing puppetry, though. It's mostly stop motion, so I'm not going to pick apart your poem. Yeah, thanks for having me, Justin.
Welcome to the show, Barnaby. Look, there are probably a lot of people, actually, that don't really know who you are. I met you at Maker Central, was mesmerized 2 or 3 years ago, Maker Central, mesmerized by watching you do your work. And I thought, oh, this guy's cool. So I kept sort of following and then met you again this year. But before we get into that, I sort of thought, why don't you just introduce yourself? Who is Barnaby Dixon?
Well, I started out as a stop motion animator, and that was a little journey in itself. There was a media center in my town that opened when I was about 13. And they offered the possibility of these courses that were relatively cheap, and a lot of teenagers kind of signed up for them at the time. And I was one of them. And they taught you how to use the kind of film equipment. At that point, it was kind of like, it's still digital cameras, but it was very early kind of DV cameras. So learning stop motion software was really useful in that course. And then for the years subsequent to that, they ran something called a drop-in session. So I think it was Fridays and Wednesdays at this place, which is called the Engine Room in my town. It's a division of Somerset Film. I was there pretty much every possible opportunity. Every time they ran these drop-in sessions, I was there just animating with plasticine and making like flick books of like little plasticine characters shooting each other's heads off and that kind of thing. So that's kind of where it started. I got a bit more ambitious with a stop motion film when I was around 19, and that got me into some, got me accepted into a couple of universities. I chose one of them. Studied in Poland for a little bit, animation, and that was a nice course, very broad. There was a bit of graphic design, a bit of poster design there. That was useful. Then graduated and couldn't find hardly any work in stop motion animation. And I was good. I graduated nearly pretty much at the top of my class, I think, with a distinction, which is the highest grade you can get. But even then, I was struggling. I mean, due to the fact that, of course, stop motion is a very rarely required skill. So I was getting work. I was getting the occasional freelance job, but it wasn't quite enough. So I was thinking, is there any way that I can kind of make my own work? And I started thinking about stop motion and its limitations, one being, well, the main one actually being the time consumption. You know, it takes just so long to do. So I started doing kind of hybrids between stop motion and kind of time lapse. I made a film in my shed around 2013, which did okay and won a couple of awards. But it still took around 2 weeks solid to make just to shoot it. So to do the sound and everything, it ended up taking months to make just a 7-minute film. Yeah. At that point, I thought, well, can I bring a bit more of live action-ness into the mix? So then I started kind of playing around with hybrid stop motion kind of puppets, where some of it happened in a kind of time-lapse format, some of it happened in real time. And then just over the course of just innovating little bits and pieces, was able to make puppets that were fully live actionable, and that's where Dabjik started, and that's kind of where my channel started, really.
Yeah, so you do puppetry mainly now, right? You've got a couple of characters that you use. Yeah. And I've only really picked up your work since about 3 years ago, so I haven't, I wasn't there from the beginning. But that sort of leads into our topic today. Today we're going to be talking about innovation. Over a long period of time, I'm sure there's been some innovating. I mean, it's clear. You started with stop motion, now you're doing puppetry.
Yeah.
So, in one of our conversations, we talked about this, actually, the importance of innovation in your work. And I thought this would be really good. And I think our audience could resonate with this, because often you need to innovate when making one's ideas reality.
Yeah.
Without innovation, you kind of don't really create anything new. And without anything new, you can't really expect to stay relevant, which in the world that's evolving constantly, it's really hard to stay relevant. And on the other side too, I started to think about this as if we don't evolve as humans, we also can't expect to stay relevant with our friends and family, which is something kind of a bit more deeper.
Yes.
I thought was interesting as well. Being a puppeteer, it's not the most common job, and it's not something that most people would probably boast about. When I think about a puppeteer, I think, unfortunately, of a weird guy called Craig Schwartz crawling through a little door on the 7th and a half floor.
Oh, yes.
Obsessed with being John Malkovich.
Yeah.
But in those early days, Barnaby, where you're in your bedroom doing all this stop motion stuff, as I call it, playing with dolls, did your friends and family have concerns, and if so, how did you deal with them?
Well, I think they did. Yeah. Some were kind of got where I was going with it more than others. Others didn't, but it's not really, I think it's, to be unsupportive in that regard, which probably is even the wrong word. It's not that they didn't care. In fact, if they were voicing concerns, it's probably quite likely they did care a lot. I'm not kind of a fan of the vilification sometimes of people that are concerned. It's like, it worked out for me, but there were, the way you said it then, I was in my mid-20s playing with dolls in my room. If that doesn't raise concern, then you got to wonder whether your family do actually care about you, because, it's a very unusual trajectory. And I happen to believe in it, and if I hadn't, perhaps I wouldn't have pushed with it. But maybe the reason I believed in it is because I knew on some level it would work, or maybe it was delusion. That I can't really speculate on, but I had a lot of people in my life that were supportive in a critical way. Is that a good way to put it?
Yeah, what were they saying to you? Were there interventions, or were there just
essentially? Yeah, there was a few of them. It didn't really work, but I appreciated the sentiment. I mean, they worked to a degree. So I remember. Someone in my extended family was pretty concerned, and another person in my immediate family kind of would sort of reach out and say, you just have to, they're saying to my parents, you just have to kick him out, you just have to go. And I was in my end, I think they got quite close to doing it, but fortunately a video went viral just around when that was happening, so suddenly there was a bit of validation. Actually, it was a bit before that. I went to an event in Bristol, and it was just before the first video went viral, and there was people like the CEOs of Aardman Animations that were just really fawning over the puppets that I had. And I was like, okay, well, this is clearly something now. And from that point on, it really gave me a kind of boost of confidence to really knuckle down. But you have to, I think, whilst it's good to maintain a certain self-belief, if you're the only one that believes it, it's also good to question it to a degree. You have to draw or pull into the equation the fact that you might be deluded. you know.
Yeah.
And so for that reason, I was really close to kind of signing up for a plumbing course or one like plumbing or being an electrician. One of those two, I was very close to doing because I thought, well, you know, the pay is fairly good and I could somewhat dictate my hours and maybe have some free time to kind of figure out some creative pursuit. But yeah, I was very close to doing that when I got lucky.
Yeah, I was going to ask you because if there's anyone in similar situation where they're like struggling with their friends and family, just don't understand, you know, they don't seem to understand what you're doing. You know, did you have any advice for them? But you said something really interesting there. Is like, you know, you have to believe in yourself, but you can't be delusional. Like if no one else is believing it, you have to look at that. I think that's super, super wise words there.
I mean, if you can get some bearing on how correct you are in your convictions, you know, like go to some local event where you're able to screen your films. I know of a few of these in Bristol, for example, but I'm sure they're all over the place in cities. And engage people's reaction. You know, you'll get a sense if people are feeling what you're feeling. And if they're not, then it might be time to reassess or try a different direction or think of backup plans. I mean, I know it's really unfashionable to say, but I don't think enough people kind of echo that sentiment. It's, you know, I consider myself quite unique and quite fortunate. And in a lot of ways, you know, as you know, just how it reads what I do, I am an exception to the rule, which also sounds a little elitist. But I can base that on the reception that I get for my work. Yeah,
I definitely see that because I see like for YouTube, for example, if you're not getting the comments of like, oh, this is great, keep up the good work, or, you know, I love the storyline or love your work, what anything like that, if you're not getting comments like that, that's also some sort of validation that maybe you need to reassess what you're doing.
Yeah, and I said, sorry to interrupt, I just realized now there's an example actually of when I was in this situation and I did have to listen to friends and family. So sorry to cut in, but I just thought of that as we were talking because although, yes, I got lucky and perhaps I got a skill set that really serves, that wasn't always the case. And I remember doing this stop motion film in my room that I was taking ages to do and I would just kind of like... turned my phone off and I kept it very dark because it was stop motion animation. And I for about a year and a half doing freelance work on the side to kind of sustain myself. But I was deluded. I was deluded. I thought this was going to be the best film in the world. And when friends and family came by and saw it, they're like, okay. And I had to see the validity in their responses. And it mounted up to the point where I was like, okay, I'm going to put this on hold. And eventually it's like, I'm going to give up on this one. I've got to try a different way. And I was fortunate to be in the position where I had kind of the support to try something like that. But I also had, it was important for me to then to assess my own delusion, which was very real at that point.
Really, really great points there because we, delusion, like you don't know you're deluded, right?
That's the trick.
And it's all about making sure you take in the outside environment, make sure you get these, you know, these cues or these signals that you are going in the right direction. And that's often what I do. I'm looking for the right clues that I'm going the right direction, whether it's people saying great work or, you know, the numbers growing or just people reaching out and connecting with you. I think that's also a way you can do it. And I think too, like you say, the family has a lot to do with it. There are family members that like I've heard of that get jealous of what you're doing and they will shoot you down. I think those you have to be very careful of. If they have valid points, I think you need to make sure you listen. So
yeah,
thanks for
that. I don't think I've faced that in terms of family members. I'm very lucky. I have a really lovely family and extended family too. And I think if the worst they did was sort of reach out to my parents and say, "Look, you have to kick him out. This is crazy." Then again, I think I read that as a different type of, well, a different manifestation of caring, you know. And I think it serves me to view it that way. And I think it's true, to be honest.
I wanted to talk a little bit about your work now. You started in stop motion, like you said, and those mm-hmm. who have followed your work, your puppets have evolved to do very interesting things, which I love, that you could probably, you'd never be able to achieve those things in stop motion. How has your innovation in your design of your puppets changed the trajectory of your career, do you think?
I think that's, I think that was kind of the key to everything, really. Without that, it wouldn't have, my career wouldn't have had any form of trajectory, well, downwards one maybe, or a level one. So I think the first video that really took off for me was that two-handed kind of bipedal humanoid looking tribal fella from 2016. And if that hadn't been something that no one had seen before, it wouldn't have taken off. And if that hadn't had taken off, then no one would have seen the, maybe at that point, 50 Dabchick episodes that I'd done prior and decided, okay, I'm going to subscribe on the back of that. So innovation was the vehicle, really. And everything else, you know, narrative, storyline, music, whatever, has ridden that, I feel.
Yeah, so talk about how did your design change in that moment? So you had Dabchick, which was... So for those who don't know, maybe you can explain who Dabchick is. We're probably going to mention him many times on this podcast.
Dabchick is a opinionated one-handed bird puppet. I say one-handed because I operate with one hand. He has wings. But he's been a part of my channel since early 2015. And Dabchick videos, they do well. People, they have kind of like a cult following. It's never been those that have really blown up. He's almost like the... he's almost like the stamina play on my channel, where he never really blows up, but he kind of holds fort in a way that people seem to really appreciate. So he's a big part of my channel. He's kind of controversial in some ways, and puppets, I think, in plenty of contexts, have gotten away with things that people couldn't say, saying things that people couldn't say, and he's no exception to that rule.
Yeah. So, like, yeah, and you went from Dabchick to, you called him the tribal puppet, but yeah. what was the design innovation there from, for example, the Dabchick design to new design?
Well, it's funny actually, because I, in that video that went viral with the Manu design, no one picks up on this, but actually in the table you can see a couple of leg pieces from an earlier version, and that version actually predates Dabchick. So that was probably, I probably started working on that perhaps late 2013, maybe. And it was a lot more like the Manu design, but so the bottom half was how it is with the legs, being controlled by the right hand, the index finger and the pinky finger of the right hand. But the top half was entirely stop motionable in terms of it had those ball and socket joints on the shoulders and the hips and the head. And the idea was that I kind of film the bits where he's walking, and then when he used to stop and move his arms, I would stop motion it, you know. And the first version of Dabchick was quite like that, in that his legs were kind of real timeable, and his head and his wings and his tail and his neck were all, and his beak were all things that I would go in almost between the frames and stop motion animate. So, Dabchick is kind of flanked by that Manu style puppet either side of it.
And was it, I mean, the reason why you innovated was because you got sick of doing stop motion, is that right? Or
well, sick, I mean, sick in terms of
the just time consumption?
Consumption, yeah, for sure, and the lack of opportunities that that it was able to afford me by virtue of the time it takes, as I say. I love stop motion animation, and if I had the time, I would do it again. There's a certain state when you get proficient enough of it, where it's at it rather, where you can get almost like meditative, and kind of a day will fly by in what seems like an hour, and it's a state of like hyper focus. I swear, it's there's nothing quite like it. But yeah, the days fly by as a result of that. So it's a little bit dangerous in that regard to indulge in.
I wanted to ask you, though, for those who are potentially struggling to innovate in their designs, maybe they're just making the same stuff over and over again. They can't feel like they're evolving in their designs. They just can't think of new things to make or ways to change things up. Do you have any words of wisdom for them that maybe they could think about?
Yeah, I think about the things that grab their attention, and in the fact that innovation is new and when it works well, it's captivating. Think about the things that captivate them, and I would say there is this kind of idea, and I'm not sure how much I believe it, but I think there is truth in it where nothing is ever invented; it's just appropriated from other things and bring it into, different things like. American music is kind of an example of that. You had the pop era of like the 50s, and you had Sinatra and people, but they certainly drew from opera and they certainly drew from like Jewish cantors and people that were in New York at the time and being being vocalists. So I think there's a appropriation can be complicated and it's a complicated topic. I have a lot of time for appropriation though, because I think you can take something from one context and present it in a different context. And I think there could be a case that every piece of art has always done that. You know what I mean? To some extent. And by kind of mixing it, you bring a certain freshness to it.
Stealing like an artist, it's called.
Stealing like an artist.
You
Yeah, I guess
you're
so.
mixing two ideas together. Maybe there's something already exists, and then another idea that exists and just smashing them together.
Yeah, I think so. I think it's that's the birth of lots of things. I mean, that is how we get born, is it not? It's two things smashing together, essentially. Yeah.
All right, let's get out of the porno talk.
We'll revisit this.
That's in the after show. Yeah. This podcast is called Making Ideas Reality or Make Ideas Reality. Let's talk about your process. Since we just talked about design, what is your process? How do you come up with a new idea? And then how do you evolve that? How do you innovate that into the final result where you're happy, for example, a new puppet?
Yeah, well, I think, and this probably comes from listening to criticism early on. I feel sometimes when people would criticize, I could see when there was like a nugget of truth in it, and I would kind of like reflect on how did I already know that, and I feel get a sense of, I don't know, how it hit my ear. It's kind of like the flavor of it, and I was thinking, okay, well, maybe I should be more cognizant when I feel or taste such flavors. I'm being pretty synesthetic about this, but it's
This flavor tastes like
I've
shit. I'm not happy with
yeah,
this.
exactly. Well, yeah, I mean, it's a blessing in a sense to know when something tastes like shit, Really, because at least you have a starting point or something to avoid. Then you have some sort of polarity to kind of repel from, So it's equally and probably in fact more important to know when something is incorrect, to know when it is correct, because by avoiding all hopefully the incorrect things, you can find a trajectory that works. And it's not going to be instantaneous, but it's just kind of crossing off things like, okay, not that, not this, not that, not this, not that. Then eventually you just kind of like ping pong yourself to a or the idea to something that's more well, less shit tasting. Hopefully.
So let's talk about your process. How do you come up with an idea, and then how do you evolve it into the final product?
Yeah. Sometimes there's some degree of kind of eureka moment. Like, wouldn't it be cool or wouldn't it be interesting if I tried this? And those eureka moments are very rarely anything approaching fully formed. You have to do that kind of process, the kind of ping-ponging. So yeah, it starts with something, and some I don't know where the initial idea comes from. That's they seem to kind of like pop into my dreams or like daydreaming, or I find when I'm fairly relaxed, sometimes things will come to me, and they can be starting points. But from that point, that's almost like, I suppose, the that's like getting the block of marble, and then you've got to get chiseling on the thing. So I can't say where the marble comes from. I don't know how much of a hand I've had in that. Maybe my temperament is quite open, so things come my way just through interpreting things, perhaps even incorrectly. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
And then I get kind of to chiseling, really. And there's certain points where you get like a, I'm being so metaphorical, so obnoxious, where you get like a block of marble or something that looks like something already. It feels, okay, this is already fully formed. I can turn it into this. So, yeah, I got so metaphorical then that I kind of forgot the question. Did I answer?
I don't know.
You can tell me if I didn't. I don't either.
Oh, well, I think like I wonder too, like let's stay in this metaphor, right?
Okay.
You're chiseling away and you see a formation in the stone itself. You know, do you chisel out that formation, or do you use that formation to evolve the idea to become something else?
I think maybe the initial hint of what shape it can be can give you an idea of what it can be, but that's not saying what it should be or what you should make it. And it looks like a certain shape to start with, and that can be the starting point, but it evolves as you work it. Like there's this puppet that I've been working on for a while, and this is this I shared it a little while ago, but it started off kind of looking kind of Celtic, and then through me thinking, okay, well I kind of want there to be some sympathetic movement, so I added these feathers. So as a result of doing that, it looks kind of tribal from a different culture now.
Right.
But this did not come fully formed. And I would have had no idea of how this would look other than the fact that I knew it had to be neon color, so it glowed under the UV light. I didn't know I wanted to use retroreflective tape, but I ended up using that. And just me kind of leaning into the process and discovering what it should be along the way showed me what it should be and what it eventually became. And I think, well, there that's an example of something that was kind of sculpted from a very neutral looking block or something, you know, where the process informed it entirely. Whereas there's other ones, for example, like we were saying, where it's a certain shape that you can lean into, or at least use it as a starting point, something to move towards to start with, but not really giving you a sense of the destination.
Because that puppet there that you just showed, he had a face with a screen originally, right?
Yes. Yeah, he did.
So like now he looks like a bird. Is it he or she? I don't know.
I don't usually say, I usually say he because it gives me the opportunity to voice it and it makes sense.
Yeah.
Initially it had a face screen, and I shared this with my YouTube audience, and I had been working on that puppet at that point, I think, for about 3 or 4 months, kind of off and on. I did, I think, a dab chick episode or two in the meantime. But the response was mixed in that some people found it very creepy. Now, I do have a face screen puppet from a few years ago that is this storyteller, kind of Halloween storyteller puppet.
Yeah.
And it works. It's creepy and it works in that context.
Right.
In this one, I wanted it to be kind of a bit more of the bread and butter of this channel, potentially. So I was thinking that people really have to connect with this design. So I didn't have to scrap it. The legs were basically, you know, as the same as they ended up being. But I did have to reassess it. And I guess that's an example of thinking, okay, how might people's criticisms be correct? Had people not criticized it, and they did it very politely, I must say, I wouldn't have probably reassessed it. There were some other things at play too. I mean, if you can avoid using a face screen, that means you don't have to have this thing in front of your face, the camera projecting it in real time. So that can be a bit uncomfortable. And, you know, it made it easier in that regard. And also the iteration of the hand controlling the top part of the puppet was a little uncomfortable. I was thinking, if I'm going to make this puppet or be as loose as possible and capture some of that kind of improvisational charm, I feel I have to be comfortable.
Right.
And there's a certain comfort level that you can attain through practice, but there are some discomforts that can't be avoided almost, you know, and it felt like the latter. It didn't feel like something I could transcend. So I was like, nah, this is the tool. I have to change the tool. You know, it's not a practice issue here. So I did.
Yeah. So it's always evolving. Like even when you think something's kind of finished, there'll be like a, oh, didn't like that, I'm going to change it.
Yeah.
It feels uncomfortable the way I drive the top half, I'm going to change the design.
Yes.
And then, hey presto, it turns into a bird instead.
Yeah.
So it's really cool. And I'm not sure we answered the question, guys. Sorry, but we're moving on.
Okay. Well, I can have another pop at it if you want me to try, and I can try and steer clear of analogies, which is usually where tangents come from for me.
It's all good.
Okay.
So we're leaving the tangents in. That's who Barnaby Dixon is.
Okay.
All right. The world's attention is like moving pretty quickly these days. Because I mean, we went from pretty quick. Let's be honest. You and I grew up with TV. Now it's, mm-hmm. you know, it's been YouTube, and now it's TikTok. And, you know, you put your work out there in various formats and various places, platforms and, you know, stages and, you know, wherever else you put it. How have you innovated in your production and your video aspect?
I think, when I used to edit animation, I would do it fairly chronologically, stop motion animation, that is, because I could afford to. You didn't have to sort of have it took so long to reset the camera. It really, in the grand scheme of things, percentage-wise, it wasn't so much of a chunk of the time frame, you know. So I'd kind of edit in camera, essentially. But this time round, there's a way that Dabchick will move from scene to scene that is quite unique. And that was something that I discovered works really well. So there's something in editing or maybe cinematography called a whip pan, you know, where you go and you're in a new frame. Well, Dabchick in this instance kind of becomes the whip, where he jumps from the center of the screen to the left-hand side of the screen. And then in the next shot, you see him coming from the right-hand side of the screen to the center of the screen. And you do it in one fluid motion, and you can make him be in one location for 1 second, and then a split second later, have him be somewhere completely different. But the audience assumes, okay, we're in the same place, which is very useful for stitching kind of like scenic-based narratives together. So yeah, that's an example there.
And it works too, because he's flying, so he's moving across, whipping through the frame, and then bringing him back.
Yeah, you
into
can believe
frame.
It because he's got wings, but it is right. Red. It's just like a simple hop from there to there.
Mm.
Another thing, I guess, would be the voiceover stuff. If you hear early Dabchick voiceover, it's very flat comparatively. It was a lot more kind of bassy, and now he really kind of moves around all over the kind of pitch spectrum. You know, so he's all over the place. So that's a big improvement, actually. I think one episode, I guess this pertains to kind of production. He got drunk in one episode, and his voice started going down and these sorts of things. And I was like, he needs a little bit of that all the time, because that's
right.
funny.
Right.
So, that's an evolution.
What would you say to people that like, maybe they feel they can't evolve in their production and their videos? Like, and they feel maybe stuck in a genre or stuck in a style. Any words of advice for them?
I've always found kind of inspiration in my interests. So maybe something that is a bit outside of the realm of what the professional field is, but you can pull it in and bring a certain freshness to it there, you know, by doing that. That's one way I would suggest it. I'm trying to think if there's anything else.
Yeah, I mean, just bringing outside sources that are not in your wheelhouse, right? I see that. I use that all the time. I bring in comedy stuff that is definitely not anything to do with making things.
Yes.
But it's interesting for me because it makes the video more enjoyable for me to do. And then two, you know, it's maybe more interesting than someone else making just the thing.
Yes. It can give you a fresh angle because it's bringing in more aspects of your personality, and if your personality is unique, which I guess all of them are, then your angle will be unique.
Okay. Yeah, I found storytelling is important for me. Like I just hooked into that, and storytelling is everything I do in my videos now. It's 1000% storytelling. And, you know, it's funny because I think a lot of people think I put it on, you know, like it's all scripted, but everything is real. It's just sometimes the camera's not on and I feel like I have to play on it. So I'm like, oh, I'll go back and I'll
Right.
re-record that because that was a bit amusing. Or in the middle of making a project or something, I'll get a funny thought. And I'll be like,
Yeah, yeah.
yeah, I should explore that. I should just do that. You know, right now
Yeah.
I'm like, so I've been out in the sun a couple of days at my day job and I got a bit of a tan. And
Yeah.
I started thinking, oh, wouldn't it be? It's a bit weird that all of a sudden I come like from one camera angle, you know, I'm white as a ghost, and then the next one I'm black. You know, like it's a bit
Yes, that's
funny,
very
right?
funny.
So, like, oh, how could I play on that? And I started thinking about like shooting a scene where like I was addicted to the sun, and I was like, you know, slapping the veins to hook in the sun because I live in Norway where there's no sun, you know, in wintertime. So, you know, but I don't know if I'm going to do that, but I thoroughly enjoyed that. And I think that tells the audience what type of weird whack job I am inside my head. And that's valuable. So, you know,
It is, and
I
there's a
see that.
degree of improvisation there, isn't there? But for you, like there are some people that work well with improvisation. And that is almost by definition a kind of freshness. So you find yourself able to kind of remain open to the, some random events that you think, actually, there could be a story if I lean into this. I think that's a great trait, actually. I think I do the same with Dabchick, where he'll be out and about and a dog will come up and sort of sniff him in a weird way. And it wasn't part of the story, but I was thinking, well, he can roll with that, actually. And I don't have to think of it at the time, but I can figure out the script later and make it. Like he reacted in a real funny, spontaneous way.
That's so. I wanted to talk a little bit about your work, and it's gained a lot of attention. You know, you've managed to catch the attention of the Henson Company in the past, and J.J. Abrams. And I've also seen you on Tested with Adam Savage, and I'm sure there were some of the highlights. But life isn't always sunshine and rainbows and cake and ass parties. So I wanted to, though, because you spoke to me before about using your ego to fuel the drive to succeed and getting hyper fixated on a project. Have you had to innovate this mindset to navigate through, you know, your journey so far and, you know, deal with your successes and failures?
I can't remember the context that I used that in, sorry.
Oh, you were talking about when you use like your sense of I'm going to make this is my thing, this I'm, you know, I've got no other option, like my work is good enough, and that fuels you to keep on going. You know, it's a little bit of what we talked about before, with the support of friends and family, right?
it's true. I mean, that would almost be kind of like an offshoot of delusion that you can harness potentially. I guess it's related to the ego, but it might be more about you're not actually serving the ego. You're serving like a product. And to the extent that it's a product that you've created, it's probably linked to the ego. But it's you become in service to something, I guess, and you have to kind of maintain, I think, a level of belief in it to either, well, get it done for one, but to make it good. You want to serve it well, so you have to constantly remind yourself of the potential of something maybe, or just retain a mindset that makes you think, this can be good, this can be great, this can be great. Because if you're not thinking that and you're dedicated so much or dedicating so much time to it, then you're gonna have to be like you're gonna the kind of self-doubt is gonna win probably, and you're just gonna be like, oh, maybe I'll do something safer. You have to, I mean, it's I guess the question is it deluded if it works out right? It can, maybe it looks deluded in the process, maybe it is deluded at the time, but when it's a success, or if it becomes a success, is that a delusion anymore? I
But
guess not.
do you have the same mindset? Like if you take on a new project now, do you find yourself, you know, getting driven by like, you know, I've got this, you know, my, you know, I'm the best at this and this is my thing? Or, you know, have you become more humbled and perhaps more, you know, grateful for things?
I think you have to have both of those things, really. I think you have to keep both of them in check too. Too much humble and maybe you lose the self-belief. Too much ego and maybe you lose sight of the truth. So I think it's a balancing act. You do need both of them.
Yeah, I mean, I often think I'm very grateful that I, you know, can, for example, have this platform, I guess, like yourself on and talk with you about some of this interesting stuff that I hope the listeners are interested to hear and hear about as well, right? So, but I think changing your mind is like your mindset, though, is a pretty scary thing for many people, especially those who've told themselves, like, you know, you kind of hear them sometimes like, oh, this is who I am. You know, I don't take any shit. You know, like if you don't like me, then fuck off, you know. But things still keep going wrong in their lives, right? And they can't work out why. their ego is standing in the way often. You know, what's the first thing you should do when you want to change your mindset? Do you have any advice on that?
Yeah, I do. I remember actually, I worked for a director last year, and I was the director of a certain part of it, but he was the overall director. And sometimes he would say, can you make this happen? And at the time I might think one of two things. Let's say it's a creative direction. I might think, no, he's wrong. I know better. Or two, that's impossible. It can't be done. So my default answer became, that's interesting. Let me think about that.
Yeah. You
know, because no one is gonna, people want the correct answer or the truthful answer at least. So if it won't work, they want to hear you let them know that, because then they can move on to the next idea. But you don't always know whether something will work in the moment or not, especially if you're working in a field that is innovation driven. You know, there's no roadmaps to these sort of things. So your gut reaction might be incorrect. And very rarely, I think, will you be put in a position where people have to know the answer right now. And you don't, you know, I found changing people's mind takes a lot of time, and changing your own mind is the same. So allow things to marinate. Think about what you're getting from voicing your opinion. Are you sharing your wisdom with people, or are you trying to win? You know, if it's the latter, maybe that needs assessing.
Yeah, I definitely had that. You know, I found myself trying to convince my, you know, my brothers or, you know, friends of like what I was doing, the way I was thinking was the right way to think.
Yeah,
and it was a lot of like, I felt like a lot of it was like I was just trying to get someone to go along the journey with me because I felt alone.
Yeah, we talked about that, didn't we?
Yeah,
I really relate to that.
Mm.
Yeah.
So I think that's a really good point. It's like changing that mindset for me was a game changer. And it's allowed me to be a bit more free. Like if I just accept who I am and that I'm going to be doing this alone, then it's okay. But because I accepted that I'm doing it alone, more people keep on coming in, you know, and joining.
Yeah.
Me. So it's a funny thing.
Maybe convincing other people who didn't need convincing or it wasn't the right thing for them. That would have been a kind of toxic manifestation of your ego. But by, you know, leaning into the confidence to do it yourself, probably that required a degree of ego, because that's maybe related to self-belief. But had you not done that, you wouldn't be it.
Yeah, I think I always have a self-belief in some way. Like, I never say I can't.
Yeah,
like,
good.
I often say that's a challenge.
Yeah,
and I'm going to probably punch a wall at some point, but that's okay, because like that's part of the process, right?
Yeah.
I wanted to, before we get into our rapid fire five, which is the quick answer questions that I give to my guests, I want to not only thank my patrons, but I get so many nice messages from people, and I thought I just want to start sharing some of them with you guys, because I think it's super valuable and it means a lot more to me than you guys think. So firstly, thank you to all my patrons. You guys rock, especially my top tier heroes, Steen, Serhus, Sylvester, Arneson, Andreas Volman, and Ryan Wilson. If you'd like to support the show, please head over to patreon.com. There's a link in the show notes. And for as little as a dollar, you can support the show and you'll get this podcast early. And you also get the after show if I manage to record one with the guest. But if you don't, of course, I just love to hear your feedback. Like from Bryce, he writes to me, "Hi, Justin. I listened to your podcast with Gus from Man Cave Makings. Great conversation, and even more credit to you being able to keep a good conversation about making. You might be the best." Well, thank you, Bryce. You stroked my ego quite well on that comment. But I would have to say, though, it's really important because literally 3 weeks ago, I was ready to throw this podcast in the bin. Like I was just done. And I was tired. I didn't feel like the podcast was going to evolve. I didn't feel I was getting any feedback. And then I got this message from Bryce and I thought, you know what? I'll keep this thing going. I think it's really important. And I just want to say to you guys, if you want to give me some feedback, if you want to send me a guest recommendation, or perhaps you're like struggling with something and you'd like to hear the guests or my two cents on that struggle and how we would deal with it, please send me an email to makeideasrealitypodcast@gmail.com. Or of course, you can send me a DM on Instagram at Garage Avenger. Now, let's get into the rapid fire five for you, Barnaby. You ready?
All right. Yeah, I think so.
All right. What's something people get wrong about you?
Oh, yeah. People, at least up until about 2 years ago, everyone thought I was about 12 years old. So so that's kind of fun.
Well, I wonder, too, is it just because of your like lack of facial hair or inability to grow proper facial hair?
I'm fairly baby-faced, too. I looked, even from... I look a little different now. Maybe lockdown took its toll and maybe going to the gym helped a little bit. But yeah, videos from a couple of years ago, I do look like I'm like 19 or something, even though I'm in my late 20s. Yeah. Yeah. It'll be a blessing one day.
What's something you like to do that has got nothing to do with making?
I like running. Running's pretty fun. I'm going to the gym, as I mentioned. I've gotten into that perhaps in the last couple of years, and I really, really enjoy that.
Well, I'm glad you enjoy running. I do it, but I don't enjoy it.
There's certain times I don't enjoy it, but it depends where you live, I suppose. My town it's mostly kind of urban, but there's like some more kind of agricultural kind of landscapes around, and that can be very nice, especially in the summer. If you ask me in the winter, maybe I'd have a different answer.
Fair enough. What's the best piece of advice you've ever been given?
I heard something, and I've been trying to find this quote for a while, and I don't know who to attribute it to, but I think it might be from Miles Davis's dad, which is kind of specific. I could be completely off the mark though. But I remember hearing him say something, if you want to make a living doing anything, you have to make sure it's something that people like, and you have to be either doing something completely new or be the best at it. Mm. You know? And I figured that's fairly good advice. Yeah.
Dabcheck is always buying things on the internet in his pursuit for true happiness.
Yeah.
What do you think happiness looks like?
A friend of mine sent me a video of George Lucas talking in some interview. I'm not sure from when, but he was talking about, I think it was happiness. And he was saying that there's certain things that you can pursue that would give you short-term pleasures, this sort of thing. But there's other things that maybe delaying gratification or kind of a sense of pride in your achievements that took a while, or achievements of people you care about, you know, that can give you a certain type of wholesome pride. That's, yeah, those kind of long-term satisfactions, those things that, like I say, delayed gratification feels like the most gratifying type of gratification to me.
Yeah, it's like something you've worked on for years and years, and then it sort of gets to that point of completion.
Yeah, something that you've pursued as a result of feeling it's genuinely important as opposed to kind of enjoyable at the time.
And the last question, who should be the next guest on this podcast?
There's someone I have in mind. I don't want to say who it is at this point because he's quite shy and this will probably, it might put him on the spot a little bit, but I'll reach out to him. He's as I say, he's quite shy. He's quite busy these days. He's just setting up a new studio, but he's really good. So am I allowed to be that nebulous?
You're the boss. So yeah.
Okay. we'll leave it there then. I'll reach out to him for you and see if he's up for it.
A mystery podcast guest, people.
Yeah, I'll tell you afterwards.
Cool. Well, stick around for the after show. Maybe you'll hear who the mystery guest could possibly be. Thanks, Barnaby. Yeah. Thank you for coming on the show. It's been an absolute pleasure. For those who want to find out who you are, where can they go?
Well, I think the best way to do it is just like Googling my name, really. They can just Google Barnaby Dixon, BarnabyDixon, and you'll find my YouTube page, my Patreon if you'd like to support me, my Instagram, Twitter, all that kind of thing. So yeah, check me out if you fancy.
There you go, guys. I'll put some links in the show notes as well. I'm going to leave you with a paraphrased quote from Theodore Levitt. Creating is thinking up new ideas, but innovation is actually executing on those new ideas. So keep that in mind, people. You have all these great ideas in the world, but if you fail to execute on them, you'll never innovate and potentially never leave your mark on this world. I hope you got something valuable from this episode, and I hope you've been a little inspired to innovate by going making your ideas reality. I'm Justin White. Thank you for listening. Until next time, keep pushing yourself, keep ballsing up things, keep learning, get inspired, and I'll catch you on the flip side. There we go.
Cool, nicely done.